Welcome to Extreme Genes, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And welcome to America's Family History Show, Extreme Genes and ExtremeGenes.com. My name is Fisher. I am the Radio Root Sleuth, and this is the program where we shake your family tree and watch the nuts fall out. Hey, today, very excited to be talking to a couple of fascinating guests. First, we're going to be talking to some people who just discovered each other. One was born in immediate post-war Germany and has discovered his half-sister here in the United States. We're going to have them both on coming up in about 8 minutes talking about that experience. Good stuff. Plus, later on in the show, I'm going to be talking to Katie Barnes from LegacyTree.com. We're going to talk about Quaker records. And if you have Quakers in your background, oh, you are in so much luck because their records are absolutely fantastic. We'll tell you what to expect from them, talk a little about the Quakers and where they settled and why they have so many descendants. This can affect a lot of us. But right now, let us check in with my good friend David Allen Lambert. He is the chief genealogist of the New England Historic Genealogical Society and AmericanAncestors.org. David, first of all, happy Thanksgiving. How you doing?
I'm doing great. It's nice to talk to you from the place where we've always considered Thanksgiving to have originated. But yeah, that brings me to my first news story for us this week.
We do have a problem with this. Here I am, a Mayflower descendant. Here you are in Massachusetts. And we have to acknowledge it looks like the South can claim the first Thanksgiving.
By a year earlier, Berkeley Plantation, known as Berkeley 100, was where a celebration such as a Thanksgiving was held in 1619. But I'm going to give you a historical angle on this. Thanksgiving was first adopted as a holiday during the Civil War.
Right.
Abraham Lincoln's ancestors came from Hingham, Massachusetts, which is very close by to Plymouth, Mass. Abraham Lincoln makes it a national holiday, and maybe it was another reparation against the South to give us the holiday and forget about their connection to it. But I think, why not celebrate both?
Absolutely. But the South does get the rights to the claim of first Thanksgiving, I think, with the 1619. There's no denying it.
Oh, absolutely. It's definitely a year before. I mean, they weren't even in Plymouth. If you recall, when the Plymouth Plantation occurred, Thanksgiving wasn't until the following year. So it's actually 1621.
Yeah, that's true. So it's a couple of years ahead.
People always think Thanksgiving was in 1620. No, they were just trying to survive.
Yeah, that's
right. They had no crops to be thankful for.
Mm-hmm.
Well, moving on to some political news with a genealogical spin. Before Donald Trump gets the new White House, he can actually buy another White House that was owned by his grandfather. As you know, he is Scottish and German. And on his German side, in the village of Karlstadt, Germany, which is well known for their wonderful sausage, a product they call pig stomach, there is a White House.
A White House, okay.
A White House that was once owned by Friedrich Trump, the grandfather of our president-elect, who, when he left from Karlstadt in 1885, that's where his family had lived. And it's up for sale.
Do you think he would want it?
Why not? I mean, just think that there's a possibility that there could be a Trump hotel on that spot.
Oh, my gosh. I hope not.
Putting on a spin, I mean, obviously, I like to tip my hat to World War II veterans, and a World War II veteran in England by the name of Frank Mokeu was honored 72 years later by the French town of Armentières. He helped liberate this town, and he was honored. Now, he couldn't make it, being a 91-year-old gentleman, over to the town in France, but virtually, they gave him a medal and honored him by virtual reality.
Isn't that incredible? And you can see this video. We've posted it on ExtremeGenes.com. And he puts on the eye goggles and actually sees children singing to him and the mayor making a presentation to him. He gets a tour of the town he helped to liberate. It was a very touching scene. And what an amazing thing to have the past meet the future like that.
It really is. And, you know, for people that are shut-ins that can't travel and all that, think how family reunions can be done so much more easier with this technology. It's really kind of fun.
That's right.
Well, I'll tell you, my next story is back here in Massachusetts again. And this shout out to Emily Peterson, who gave birth to her first baby, Samuel, at 1:39 a.m. before the clocks turned back the other week.
Oh, no.
Now, here's the catch. You know that siblings always have rivalry, especially with twins, who came first.
Right.
So they're the oldest. So Samuel's born at 1:39 a.m. Then 31 minutes later, she delivered Ronan. Ronan's birth came after the time change. So his birth officially was 1:10 a.m. instead of 2:10 a.m. So the second child on the clock becomes the first child.
That's so unique, though. They're going to have fun with that throughout their lives.
Oh, I think great. It's wonderful. So congratulations to her two bouncing baby boys, no matter who came first. That brings me to my tip for the week. Nowadays, you can do videos of ultrasounds and see the baby in the womb. And, you know, I have pictures and ultrasounds of my kids. I'm sure you do of yours.
Sure.
How about your earliest photograph, Fish? What do you have for yourself? How old are you in that?
I'm an infant, and I'm assuming it was taken at home after I came back from the hospital a few days later.
Same thing with me. I was born on a Friday. The photographer wasn't there when I came home on Monday. So I'm 3 days old. My parents are holding me. It's a great picture. I love it. Now, then you go back to gathering these type of pictures for our ancestors, our parents, our grandparents. As my parents, I have a picture of my dad as a toddler, not as an infant. I have my mother as an infant. My grandparents, one of them I don't have any baby pictures, let alone any picture before he turned 60. Other ones, they're small kids. So creating a family album that would include sort of the cute baby picture of your ancestors and your family tree might be a fun project to think about during Thanksgiving and holidays coming up.
Everybody only has one first picture, right?
Until somebody finds an earlier one, I suppose.
There you go.
AmericanAncestors.org welcomes Extreme Genes listeners, as always, to become guest members of NEHGS by joining AmericanAncestors.org. You can go on and try a free database. Since we had that connection with Abraham Lincoln, whose ancestors came from Hingham, and that whole story about Thanksgiving, let's offer this week the Hingham, Massachusetts vital records from 1637 to 1845. Maybe you'll find out you're a distant cousin with Abraham Lincoln as well. That's all I have to wrap it up from the second home of Thanksgiving.
Right. All right, David, take care. Have a great feast this week, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Talk to you soon, my friend.
Coming up next, we'll talk to siblings who didn't know they had a sibling until DNA came along.
This is so much fun to get my next guests on the show. And I always love hearing about these reunions that seemingly pop out of the air, things that could not have happened maybe even 5 years ago or 10 years ago. And I have on the line today Anita Smolik from Napierville, Illinois, and her half-brother Jim Sloma. He's from Ontario, Canada. And welcome to you both.
Thank you.
You guys have known each other for a total of what, just a couple of months at this point?
October, yeah, about 2.5 months.
That's unbelievable. And what a story this is, because this goes back some 70 years, actually more. It goes back to World War II, when your father parented a child with a woman in Poland back in the day, and that was your mother, Jim.
Yes, it's not quite correct. She was Polish, okay?
Mm-hmm.
She was taken as a slave laborer, and her father died in a concentration camp in Auschwitz. She had a sister also that was moved into another country, and she was taken as a slave laborer into Germany. So he met her in Germany, and this is very, very early. Poland fell end of September, started 1st of September. By end of September, it was all over, and I think there was a certain period of time before they started getting into these programs. So she met him after the war in Germany.
Okay.
My mother did not tell me his name. She was a Catholic. She absolutely did not say anything, except the only information I had was that he was an American soldier and he took her to a dance. That was the only information. And basically, Amy got my DNA, then she got her DNA.
Your daughter.
Out there, yeah.
Well, and let's get into that. Now, Anita, did you have any hint that your father might have had another child?
Not that he had another child, but he actually had told my mother, my son, and my biological full brother that he had a girlfriend in Germany during the war. I don't even know if he knew she was Polish. He might have thought she was German.
I don't think for myself he would have even known that my mother was pregnant, because these soldiers would be probably moving along at certain periods of time.
Sure. So let's talk about the process here. Anita, you had no clue about this. Jim, of course, you knew you had a birth father out there somewhere. And in this case, both of your daughters somehow started researching your family lines. Let's talk to you, Anita, first about your daughter and what she was looking for.
Well, she told me that she wanted to test her DNA because a friend of hers had done it, and it was mostly for finding her ethnic roots to confirm what she might have thought they were. And I didn't realize that you could also find somebody that might be connected to you through DNA, but I guess that's how Amy got in touch with her. And
now let's explain who Amy is.
Amy is Jim's daughter.
Okay, and so Amy was looking as well, Jim, right? And what was she looking for?
I was on the database about 5 years ago, and she put her DNA, at that point I said, oh, you're not going to find him. Well, it's impossible. I do remember saying that to her.
Sure.
She put her DNA out, and I think she got close with somebody, meaning she hit somebody that was a second cousin. That was Anita's niece.
Okay.
Yeah.
So who found out first, Anita or Jim?
I think Anita, your daughter got in contact with you that you might have a half-brother or something like that.
Well, she emailed me, and she lives overseas, so we talk on Skype once a week. And it was early that Sunday, so it must have been the Sunday of Labor Day weekend, I think, or the week before, where she emailed me. And she says, you're not going to believe this, Mom. I got this email from a woman in Canada who says we may be related and asked me if either my grandfather or my great uncle served in World War II. And then she's forwarded me the email, and it had my maiden name on there. And I thought, well, how would she know my daughter's, my maiden name, because it wasn't listed on the test that my daughter took. So we knew that she knew about our family. And then my daughter said, I'm giving her your email address. And then Amy, it was just Jim's daughter, sent me an email with probably some of the same information. And within, I don't know if it was that day or the next day, we arranged to talk on the phone. And then I also talked to Jim later that day. And this first cousin, that Faye Smiley that I mentioned earlier, had connected with them a week earlier, I think, or proven through the DNA. So she called me up. I haven't spoken to her since we were children. So it was one day of just a million phone calls, and at that point, Amy said to me, would you be willing to take a DNA test? And I said, sure. So a few days later, I took the test, and it wasn't supposed to come back for 6 to 8 weeks, and it actually came back in about 4 weeks. I don't know, it was very soon that it came back, and Amy was the one that contacted me, and Jim was visiting his other daughter at the time, so she couldn't get a hold of him right away, but she emailed me. She said, did you get those results? You and Jim are half siblings. And I said, for some reason, I don't know why I missed it in my email. I went back and I saw it there finally. It turned out the results came back on my birthday, which was really a nice birthday present.
Boy, I'd say. Now, that's probably an email you'd want to actually have framed.
Yeah. Well, I printed it out. I printed out the, because it lists all the relatives, and Jim's name was at the top, and I don't really know what the term centimorgans means, but his number was the higher
right.
than anybody else on the list. And the second one listed was my first cousin that had also connected with them earlier, and hers was even less than that. So
you were the one most likely to be surprised by this, because I'm assuming, Jim, of course, you knew somebody was missing out there. You didn't know who your birth father was. Anita, you had no idea that you had another family member. How did you take this news?
I didn't sleep for several nights after that. I mean, so many thoughts were going through my head. It was shock. It was amazement. I immediately emailed my brother and told him, and he was excited about the whole thing also, and it took me a while to even recover from the shock.
Yeah.
It was really shocking.
Jim, for you, this was the breakthrough you've been waiting for your whole life.
Yes, here's the more interesting thing. I was the only child. My mother did marry, and I was the only child. So hence, I thought, let's say 2 months ago, whatever it was, that I do have a connection.
Yes, and now you have several siblings and nieces and nephews.
Yeah. Oh, yeah? Everything changed.
I would imagine so, and all for the good, right?
Oh, yeah.
So, Anita, when are you two going to get together?
We actually already have met. Jim and his wife came down to visit me Halloween weekend, actually it was, for a few days, and we just got along so well. I mean, it was as if I'd known them my whole life. We just had a great time together. We went out for some meals. We walked around Naperville. I took them to my chorus rehearsal, so they got to hear my chorus. And it was wonderful. I wish they could have stayed longer. I'm planning to go out there now to visit them next summer, so hopefully it will be a longer time with them.
How about a reunion, though? The next generation, they're the ones that did the work, apparently.
Yeah. Well, my son, who lives in Naperville also, he came to dinner and lunch with us the 2 days that they were here, and he would like to go out to Canada. My daughter wants to come out here to Canada, and I think Jim's two daughters might be coming to this reunion of cousins, too, next summer. It isn't definite when, but it's tentative now.
Isn't that amazing to know that the answers to your questions, Jim, were in your blood, your DNA, all along? Now you've matched them up.
Yep. And, of course, anybody that comes to Canada, you got to go to Niagara Falls.
Right.
That's sort of the plan, and any other things. And Amy's planning to bring her family. I have two grandsons. They'll be there.
Well, it sounds like the beginnings of a new family organization.
Mm-hmm.
Herbert Smiley is the father. Have you guys started working on his history a little bit from what you've learned, especially his war years from both of your moms?
Yes.
Anita's given me a lot of information about him in that respect. Both parents are dead, of course. And in a way, I felt it was best that we actually did it this way, because I know when I talked to my mother, she did not want me to be looking for him. And that's one of the reasons she did not give me his name, because she says, I'm old, bring shame, and this sort of stuff. And that way you have, you might say, all the participants
yeah.
not there, or nobody's insulted.
And yet it's now a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations to you both on the discovery, and to your daughters for making this happen.
Yeah. They're the ones that did the work and just submitted our saliva to be analyzed, and then we do meet. And there was a little concern how I would be accepted, but it was accepted. And once they saw me, they saw similarities of
sure.
my father. Yeah, I looked at his pictures, but you see, I didn't have any pictures, anything.
And now you do.
Yeah, you're looking for what are the similarities in this.
Well, he's Jim Sloma. He's from Ontario, Canada. She's Anita Smolik from Naperville, Illinois. Thanks both. Half-siblings recently discovered, and a life-changing event that's going to carry you the rest of your days.
Yes, we hope so.
Thanks for coming on.
You're welcome.
Thank you. It's great talking to you.
And just a reminder, by the way, if you haven't signed up yet, go to extremejeans.com, and up on the upper right side of our homepage, you will find a place where you can sign up for our weekly Genie newsletter. It is absolutely free. We've got links to all kinds of great stories, great audio. I do a column in it each week, and we would love to have you be a part of our Extreme Genes community with the weekly Genie newsletter. And coming up next, we're talking Quakers, the religious sect. You know, I think a lot of us growing up thought about Quakers as being those people in the odd hats that you'd see on the oatmeal box. But for many of us, they also represent some of our ancestors. And one of the things you might run into when you start digging up your ancestors are Quaker records. And to get into that just a little bit more, I thought I'd talk to my friend Katie Barnes from LegacyTree.com. Katie, those Quakers came over awfully early in the game, didn't they?
They did. They were a small but very significant group, a Protestant separatist group, dissenters from the Church of England that came over in the 1600s through Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Pennsylvania. In fact, Pennsylvania was actually founded by a Quaker, William Penn. He wanted a place where Quakers could thrive and worship freely and for religious pluralism to exist in general.
Right. And of course, many of them eventually started moving inland. North Carolina in the 1700s became quite a stronghold as well.
Definitely, and then kind of through the mid-Atlantic and Midwestern states, Indiana and Ohio obviously have large populations as well.
And because we had so many early Quakers, we have so many descendants these days of Quakers. So I thought we'd talk a little about Quaker records today, because they're really quite unique and special.
Oh, yeah. And part of that is based in Quaker religious practices as well. Unlike some of the top-down formal denominations like Catholics or Evangelical Lutherans, Quakers didn't and still don't practice sacraments like baptism or communion. And so when you're looking into Quaker religious records, you're not going to find those. And that's a little bit surprising and different for most people who are accustomed to working within other Christian groups. The other big thing to know is that their gatherings were called meetings. So the meeting records are what you're usually looking for. They
right.
consisted both of the worship and also of administrative topics covering, you know, births, marriages, deaths, but also movement, disciplinary actions, all kinds of things like that. And they're extremely detailed.
Yeah, you could get in a lot of trouble. You talk about the disciplinary actions. If you married outside of the faith, you were pretty much gone.
Yeah, and they would record that, and often in a lot of detail about, you know, what happened exactly. And if you wanted to come back later and found a way to do that, then they would probably record that as well.
Yeah, they did. And I love the movement thing. They would say, okay, yes, this person has left this group and has gone over to this other meeting. And then in the records of that meeting, you see where they were received, and it says where they came from. So you can really track them pretty well.
Yeah, and that's extremely useful in earlier eras when we don't really have those detailed censuses, federal censuses and things like that to rely on.
And the nice thing is there were people who went out and actually gathered all these records and made some incredible big books on Quaker records. And Henshaw was the one that comes to mind. I worked with it years ago because my wife has a lot of Quaker ancestry. How many volumes? Do you know how many volumes Henshaw did?
Ooh, I think there are six.
Six.
Don't quote me on that, but I think there are.
And I remember going to the family history library in those days, and those books were picked over. I mean, they were beat. They were in bad shape because so many people had gone through them to find records. There are some issues, though, with those records in terms of how they're interpreted, don't you think?
Well, like anything else, they're a compiled source, and you do have to be careful with accuracy there. There are mistakes that can creep in when somebody's making compilations of that size.
Sure. Yeah. And also the fact that, for instance, the dates would get swapped. You know, for instance, was it June 12th or December 6th? And so often we'll see things that are taken from those records and they get swapped. And you'll see half one way, half the other, depending on where you look. And you have to wonder which one is right. And you got to get back to that original source.
That is definitely a concern, and partially also because Quakers used kind of a different date system to begin with, which probably contributed to that confusion. They numbered months instead of using the names, you know, May, June, July, as we do. That
right.
was a religious preference. And so they might say 16th of, you know, month three or something like that instead.
With the original records, I don't think have been out there very much, although we're starting to see more and more of them. Most folks, I think, relied on the Henshaw books in the past when researching the Quakers. Are you aware of where the original records are now?
You know, I'm not really sure. There could be a lot of different places. I know that the Swarthmore College Library in Pennsylvania has a lot of original records, both meeting records and, you know, more personal things like diaries and personal papers. I'm not sure about most of the rest.
Diaries. They have those in Swarthmore.
They do, yes. That was a very big Quaker hub there, and so they've had a lot of donations over the years and just collecting from local families and making those available in their special collections.
Is that online at this point or yet to be digitized?
I think they're still only available archivally, so I'm sure that you could submit a request or send someone to look it up for you.
Yeah, you know, we become so dependent on what's online, and we start to think if it's not there, then it's not to be found. But I've always maintained there's like 90% of what's out there is in archives. You have to make the trip, right?
You really do. And some of those big genealogy sites, MyHeritage, Ancestry, are doing a fantastic job of digitizing a lot of things, and especially Quaker records. There are a number of databases, mostly covering monthly meetings now online. But as with most topics in genealogy, it's unwise to restrict yourself to the internet, like you said, assuming that's all that there is.
Right. Absolutely. Here's something for you, Katie. How might somebody have an idea that their ancestors were Quakers?
That is a very good question. To begin with, there's the usual way. Knowing something about the geographic area in which your ancestors lived, and if there was a high population of Quakers that lived there to begin with. You can also check traditional genealogical records, obituaries, local histories, especially in high Quaker areas. They'll often mention religious preferences. You can check in local cemeteries. And pay attention also to the military service of the men. Quakers religiously were pacifists and conscientious objectors, meaning that they didn't really believe in participating in the military and in warfare. And so if you're noticing that you're not finding a lot of your male ancestors in those military records, that might be kind of a flag for you. Of course, that's not guaranteed, but it might be a clue for sure.
Sure. Now, a lot of these early Quaker families, because of the great records, are more easily traceable back to England and the source of Quakerism than other religious sects. Would you agree with that?
Oh, definitely. Absolutely. Yeah.
How far back would you say it goes in England that you're aware of? I know as George Fox was the founder, and I know that this we're talking about the 16th century. And so it was really, what, another 100 years before they started coming here?
Yes. Yeah, that sounds about right. So they started coming to the U.S., or what would become the U.S., in the 1600s, early 1600s. It was fairly early, but you're right. I mean, there was another entire almost century there before that, but they were still in England.
And the names of the families within the groups also are pretty consistent. I mean, you can almost come to the point you can recognize, oh, that's a Quaker name, because they were early established in the continent.
Yeah, that's another fun feature of Quaker research, and it's always great when that can happen.
Let's talk about descendants, Katie. There are a lot of famous descendants that come from these Quaker groups. Who can you name?
Richard Nixon was.
Right.
And he really made a big deal about that.
Yeah.
with his opponent, John F. Kennedy, being Catholic. John Cadbury, who founded the Cadbury Chocolates.
We can thank him.
Thank him, yeah, for sure.
Yep.
The actor James Dean, actually, was raised in Indiana and as a Quaker.
I didn't know that one. James Dean, really? He was the coolest of the cool.
Yeah, apparently. He is buried at a Quaker cemetery.
No kidding. So, I had no idea.
Yep.
See, there you go. Well, if you've got Quakers, you're lucky, because this is the kind of research you can do yourself. It's easily available in the Henshaw books and apparently other places, as you've mentioned, Katie, where you can find diaries and other interesting Quaker pieces of memorabilia and records.
Yes. And as with everything else, the Family History Library is a great resource. There are numerous books, compiled sources, indexes there that you can use as well.
Absolutely. So your next trip to Salt Lake City, Utah could be very memorable. Well, very good. Thank you so much, Katie Barnes from LegacyTree.com. Thanks for joining us and talking about the Quaker records.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And coming up next, it's Tom Perry, the Preservation Authority, talking about the deadlines that are coming upon us for digitizing and software gifts you might want to look into for your genie. You've been all over the place lately.
Oh, yeah. I've been out of town the last 3 weeks, traveling all over. In fact, our latest stop was Colorado Springs, which was a lot of fun. We had this great big family history expo inside this humongous library. It was so neat. It was three stories tall. A lot of people came through. We had a lot of genies come in and introduce themselves. It was really a lot of fun. Some new software that's out that's really exciting, and just all kinds of things, which is great because it's the holidays, so it's time to start getting holiday gifts, and we've got some really good ones to tell you about.
Boy, no kidding. But one thing we have to warn people about, you're almost out of time now to digitize film and video, right?
Exactly. Last time you can do film is usually about the first part of December. Video, usually we and probably most people out there can do it about 2 weeks before Christmas, 2 weeks before the holidays. So it just kind of depends exactly what all you're doing, how busy the people are around you. So don't wait till the last minute and go in someplace on December 23rd and see if they can do your videos and your films, because it won't happen.
Right. There is a line. With this stuff.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. So you went to this convention, this conference in Colorado Springs, and you came back all lit up. I can always tell when you found something new that turns you on. He's such a geek. So let's hear about some of the software.
Okay. Some of the software has been around for a while, but they've added new modules to it that do really, really cool things. Anybody that's into family history at all, if you are digitizing your videos, your films, your audio, and anything like that, and you want more than just a CD or a DVD that you can hand out, if you want to go the extra mile and do some really cool things, you've got to get the software called Heritage Collectors. You know, we don't sell it in our store, but it is by far the best software out there. If you have any questions, just go to tmcplace.com and you'll see a link to their webpage. As far as I'm concerned, if I could have one piece of software, this would be it.
Yeah, it's pretty unique, isn't it? Because there's so many things you can do, like you can move the cursor over somebody's face and then have some history come up about the person or about the picture or about how old they were or something about them, at least their names, right?
Oh, exactly. It's unlimited. In fact, it is so cool. As you mentioned, you move your cursor over somebody will come out, oh, that's Grandpa Maud or whatever, and then it'll have a drop down, say, oh, we have some audio, we have some photos and all these kind of things, and you can go on the little carriers and go and find out all this cool stuff about them, which is just absolutely amazing.
Imagine putting the cursor over a picture, clicking a mouse, and hearing their voice.
Oh, that's what's so special about this kind of software. You have the little AIFF or MP3 files, and as you say, you click it, and there's Grandpa talking to his great-great-granddaughter that's never heard his voice, heard all these stories about him, but you're actually hearing his voice tell some stories. It's just priceless.
Absolutely. All right, what else did you run into on this conference?
There's another new software out that's called Kindex, K-I-N-D-E-X.
Yes, I've seen this. It's incredible.
For people that have, you know, old things that, you know, grandma and grandpa and different people have written down, it's kind of hard to read, and they don't even teach cursive in school anymore. It's just really crazy. So what it does, it allows you to look at your monitor and scan in what you're transcribing, and then on the other side, it shows you what you've typed in, so you can constantly go back and forth between them without having to open a window, close a window, see where you are, have notes on your desk. They're all right there in front of you.
That is a great idea.
Oh, it makes it so nice, because when you're transcribing things, you're looking down the paper, you lose your place on the page, you go back and
yes.
forth. Where this isn't, your eyes are just going right to left, so it's really easy. And you can just go on to Google and Google Kindex, K-I-N-D-E-X. And, you know, even if you don't want this stuff for yourself, you've got to have somebody in your family that you've dumped all your genealogy, all your family history on, and say, you do it, I don't have the time. It's a nice gift, a nice way to just say, hey, thank you for the extra mile that you're going for our family to do these things. And get them some like Kindex or Shotbox or Heritage Collectors, which are really, really great.
All right. What do we have coming up?
I'm going to tell you about some real cool things we discovered about Shotbox.
We'll tell you what that is, too. Tom Perry is here from TMCPlace.com. He is our preservation authority. And we should mention, Tom, last week you mentioned, I think, a company called Disc Savers.
Correct.
And I had some emails about that. Tell us a little more about that company. What do they do?
Okay. It's a great, great company. If you ever have a hard drive that goes down or thumb drives or anything that you can't access, you've tried everything you can, don't format it. Call these guys. And a lot of times we don't give out phone numbers, but this one's really, really important. It's an 800 number. So it's 800-440-1904. They'll take your device or whatever, and they go over it in one of these dustless environments. They actually take it apart. They go in and try to find it segment by segment, sector by sector. And the neat thing about this is, say you've got 5,000 photos that were on a hard drive that doesn't exist anymore. You think you've lost them all. They might not be able to recover every single one, but since they're going over it sector by sector, they'll be able, okay, here's a picture, pull it out. Here's a picture, pull it out. And they might get 3/4 of them back. They may get them all back,
right.
But it's a great place to send anything to. So just call them with your questions and say, hey, this is what I have, this is what my problem is, and then they can tell you, usually over the phone, yeah, go ahead and send that in, that's something we can work with, or you've gone and reformatted it with Clorox Revealer and so it goes away and then you can't do anything with it anymore.
Oh.
So they're really good about that kind of stuff.
All right. What else do we have that you found out about in Colorado Springs on that convention?
This was so crazy. We talked a little bit over the last month about Shotbox. There are some people that are our genies that came into us, and one of them has a little bakery. And she bought a Shotbox, and she sets her cupcakes and different things that she's made and used a Shotbox to take pictures of it to put on her online store. It's just crazy. We've had people, oh, we use it for eBay. We have a jewelry company. We make jewelry. You know, we use it for that. We do jams and jellies. And I'm thinking, wow, these people are so creative. Our genies are smart, and they're creative.
Well, and think about it in terms of, like, grandma and what her recipes have been. And maybe she could make a pie or something, and you could photograph it in the Shotbox.
Exactly. In fact, they have a deluxe model that has a green screen behind it, and everybody should know what those are. If you don't, if you watch your weatherman where he's pointing the weather map that doesn't really exist, it's a green screen. So we had somebody along your lines, they had a plate that had a little boy from back in the early 1900s. And so what they did is they shot that, and they had his shoes bronzed and the old tag when he was in the hospital. These people kept everything. And so they green screened it, and then they ran some old home movies they have of the kid in the background while the plate and the bronze shoes were fading in and out. And they made something so totally cool. It's absolutely amazing. In fact, we even had one kid that borrowed their mom's Shotbox and got her Barbie dolls and actually did still frame animation and posted it on YouTube.
Who would have thought, right?
Exactly. This is a great gift for the holidays. You can get them for as little as $100, and it's money well spent. I guarantee your kid will figure out something cool to do besides family history or preserving all your old heirlooms. It's just absolutely wonderful.
All right. What else do we have? We're running out of time.
Okay. Last thing I want to talk about. A lot of people have questions on scanning. Always scan at the highest DPI you can, but always remember what your end goal is. If you're just going to be scanning stuff for home photos, don't go and scan it at 3,000 DPI. You don't need that. You're going to have the big files. You don't need TIFFs. You can do JPEGs. If you've got like thousands of pictures, don't go to Costco or someplace and buy a $200 scanner. Rent one from Easy Photo Scan for like $300 for an entire week. You've got the high-quality scanner that will take care of all your needs and in the long run save you money.
All right. Great companies all. Thanks so much, Tom. Good to see you. And if you have a question for Tom Perry, you can email him at asktom@tmcplace.com. See you again next week.
I'll be here.
Well, that wraps up the show for this week. Thanks once again to Jim and Anita, the half-siblings who didn't know about each other for their entire lives, but it was their daughters getting into DNA that found the connection. Also to Katie Barnes for talking about the Quaker records. If you missed any of the show, catch the podcast on iTunes, iHeartRadio, or ExtremeGenes.com. Talk to you next week. And remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family.